My name's Syed Mohsin Abbas. I'm a television journalist. I've worked in the business for several decades. I'm also an activist, sort of a general social justice activist. I've carried out various festivals, arts programs around the UK over those 2 or 3 decades. Lots of kind of what I'd call Sufi shrine music, I think. Yeah, that's the kind of other side of me. But mainly it's political, social justice activism and journalism, which covers mainly West Asia or European affairs.
Now, a lot of the focus, though, has been in the Middle East, hasn't it? And in fact, it seems that the Middle East is a focus for much of the world's attention, and things that happen in the Middle East seem to sort of, have ripple effects around the rest of the world. And I understand that you've just been censored from Facebook, and I'm sure you're not the first person that this has happened to. But can you just explain, go through as a journalist, why, and how you've been taken off Facebook? Because obviously, this is quite an important way that many journalists use to spread their work.
I mean, social media was a godsend to many alternative, if you like, narrative journalists or alt media, if you like, because the mainstream media had increasingly quite clearly become government run. Wherever you go, it tended to have a huge stamp of government, if you like, edicts and establishment edicts. So social media was meant to be this big liberation for people who really wanted to express independent truth. What's happened over the last 3 or 4 years, though, is that huge behemoth, the corporate social media sort of outfit, Facebook included, Twitter, perhaps others, it's increasingly clear that actually things are completely changing now. I think intelligence services, deep state, governments, they've all got involved with using this term fake news as their pretext for moving in on social media and the freedom that people have had to say what they want. I mean, already the freedom was very dubious because algorithms and whatnot are also said to control and manage how far people's words were getting out, and of course, primarily their businesses, these sites. So a lot of it, the traffic, could easily be controlled. It's been alleged and said. And I think my case, I guess, is similar to many, many cases now. I looked at a video, viewed a video which Facebook had allowed to be posted on their site. And often what they're doing is banning people who are reposting videos that they've already allowed onto their system, which is really bizarre in the first place. But my case was really a video of Palestinian man in a wheelchair being kicked over by the Israeli army. Now, it was a pretty graphic video of this wheelchair fellow being kicked over. So clearly one's emotions get a little bit stoked when you see 4 or 5 fully armed soldiers with a track
Well,
record of
I mean,
course.
obviously, this sort of thing is very difficult to do on the radio. So what I'll do is I'll put up a link to the video itself on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But if you could just describe this video and then, what your response was that somebody at Facebook took exception to.
Well, as soon as I saw the video, there was a man in a wheelchair, basically having a discussion with 3 or 4 soldiers who were surrounding him with fully weaponized with their machine guns or whatever. These were Israeli soldiers who were being pretty, obviously quite loud and nasty to him. One of them chose to flip his wheelchair over so that the man in the wheelchair fell to the ground. This is a sort of unarmed, defenseless, disabled man who goes to the ground. And other soldiers then surround him, as well as various other people who were gathered around the incident, and they opened fire. You could visibly see shots being fired at the people around there. So again, it was a sort of example of ongoing Israeli, if you like, oppression of civilians, Palestinian civilians. And in this case, it was absolutely diabolical, a disgusting show of disregard for a disabled man. I mean, what threat could he offer? So I wrote a comment. You have put comments up so people kind of get the idea. I only wrote a one-liner on this occasion, and I alluded to the cowardly, rabid dog nature of the Israeli military for that action.
Okay, then, so you actually use the words cowardly, rabid Israeli dogs.
Israeli military. I said Israeli, not Israel. I said Israeli military dogs. So to okay. me, that's a sort of, it's a metaphor for basically a pack of wild dogs that attack prey, which is easy for them to eat. So to me, it's a sort of, it's a colourful expression of
I mean, it's a well-known expression, the dogs of war, isn't it? I mean, this is very well-known. And also, of course, the idea of soldiers having a skirmish with civilians. This is also really out with the rules of war.
Yeah, I mean, attack dogs is a common term as well. It's, again, it's the use of language. But the Facebook's ability to basically just switch off without any... recourse to real contesting of the issue, and there's absolutely no clarification of what their community rules are. So they dictate everything, and they dictate the whole kind of scenario. So you can't really do anything. I mean, Palestinian voices we know are particularly being stifled within all of this scenario. I mean, I can give you an example of. An organization called, I think, the Palestinian Information Center, which had nearly 5 million followers on Facebook, which was just shut down at a whim. So they're doing this to many, many platforms which aren't conforming to their, if you like, agenda. So Zuckerberg, of course, has also, appointed an actual former Israeli, well, is the director general of the Israel's Justice Ministry on their oversight board. She was actually appointed on their board to oversee what's going on. Her name is Emmy Palmore, I think. Palmore is going to have her own agenda. So if we've got people like this, on the actual board, what hope is there for people like myself or others who've got who are going to express emotionally or otherwise within certain parameters, of course, our expression of disgust at the behaviour.
I'm sure Facebook will say, well, actually, it's our platform. You know, we're a private business. We can censor anyone we want.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. But the fact of the matter is that these guys themselves are not really subject to any particular rules and regulations or laws. I mean, there's a lot of things they seem to be able to do and get away with without any recourse. So maybe it calls into the question who actually does monitor and control these particular social media outfits. If it's going to be the usual suspects, you know, if it's going to be the usual Zio Western imperialist institutions, and that's exactly what it seems to be now. They seem to have their hands in that pie. If, of course, Facebook ever was an independent outfit, because all of these transnational corporate companies, ultimately, if you look at the linkage, they're all part of a happy, cozy little cabal, which all works in tandem. We had the situation before where mainstream media was dominated, for instance, in Britain by six major chaps, including Rupert Murdoch, of course, the Barclays brothers. They dominated British media by and large. And now we've got this situation where a handful of these corporate transnational social media outfits are also controlling what people think and say. I think we're just getting basically a takeover of that social media space by the usual suspects behind the scenes. But it's just you've got a new set of people like the Zuckerbergs of the world who are the ones who are fronting this particular area.
I mean, it's interesting because I mean, I've covered the Bilderberg conferences for many years, and the early days, most of the major people there seem to be banking and oil related. Obviously, there's the usual royalty, you know, sort of sprinkling of them as well. But that was people like the Rockefeller family, etc. The Rothschild family that went along to some of the early meetings, for example, as well, and apparently were quite influential. Now it seems that rather than Rockefeller basically was an oil monopolist, managed to get a massive monopoly in oil, and now we're moving towards a stage where Google and Facebook, these sorts of groups and individuals, and Microsoft particularly, are the sort of tech monopolists. They are. It's almost as if in the old days it used to be oil. Now it's a social media and it's technology that is the great potential for the future that these people want to control. I mean, so what I suppose I'm saying here is we've had through television in maybe in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, mainstream journalism, we've had more balance than we've had today. And now that balance is gone. People have been, as you were saying, sort of chased, if you want, you know, herded onto social media. And they've seen that as liberating. Do you think maybe it's time now social media is going to go the way of television? The golden age is over.
I think so. I think that it's also not an accident, because if you were part of this kind of elitist sort of unit, which tends to have, well, it sort of corners most of the commons, it uses usury as a means of keeping that wealth within a small cabal of elitists around the world, what would you do? You want to control and manage the world, because that's your economy. This is the fact of the people you've mentioned, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and the gangs that are out there. You know, the fact of the matter is that they control 70% of the world's economy, with about 130 CEOs around the country. They also own about 6 or 7 guys own half of the wealth, which they own the same amount of wealth as half the planet's population. When you've got that kind of level of power and wealth, it's naive and rather stupid to think that they don't exert influence and power proportionate to that wealth. And that is exactly what is happening. And what they've done now with social media, I mean, you could argue that they would have needed initially to make out that it was all very free and independent, because everybody's raced to it, haven't they? If everybody thought right at the beginning that this is all part of some sort of method to find out who we are, try to work out what our desires are, try to sort of look at our profiles. Well, if we all thought it was a massive profiling exercise right at the beginning, none of us would have joined the damn thing. But clearly, they've got people hooked on those basic needs and necessities of human beings, which are social interaction, you know. And they've done it through these clever techniques of, disarming people. But people's details are all up there on Facebook. People's algorithms of their choices, of their likes or dislikes, are now totally available to these massive companies and to these elitists. So, what you could argue is that social media and the modern internet is the greatest control mechanism they've ever had at their disposal. More information, more ability to watch, to hear, to listen to what we're doing, and to gauge what people's thoughts and opinions are, and to be able to obviously then to engineer and to direct that traffic, either for people to buy, you know, to be consumers of the kind that they want, or to control them in terms of social political viewpoints. Because there's a lot of arguments to say that the Arab Spring, color revolutions around the country are being engineered partly through the support of social media. There are huge methods which are potentially there for making sure that certain views, certain ideas are, if you like, saturated at a certain time. I don't know how true that could be and what scale they're capable of doing, but it's certainly feasible given the control of that social media.
Well, we were told, weren't we, that the Black Lives Matter protests a month or so ago were organized on social media. But look, Facebook themselves would say that, I'm afraid, sorry, but you have ticked two at least of their boxes. One of them is, you know, using the word dogs to dehumanize people, these soldiers in this case, and also the Israelis, the Zionists, the Jews are a protected religious group. And so you've ticked loads of boxes. I would imagine someone's reported you, ticked those boxes for you, and Facebook has said, sorry, you know, you're going to have to be suspended now.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that you can make these kind of tick boxes as much as you like. The tick boxes are declared by the exact people that I've been talking about, who have an agenda, who have a political and a racial and a cultural and an imperialist agenda. The fact of the matter is that in ordinary day language, you will use language like that, which is metaphorical. Metaphor is a part of human discourse. The fact of the matter is we use it on a daily basis. Swearing is a different story. If you were to abuse somebody with swear words, to me, that's a red line. The red line for these guys is using metaphor, animal metaphor, for an institution like the Israeli army, which is detestable in its actions, is proven in terms of statistics and actual factual evidence about what it does and its behavior. In fact, if anything, I would probably condemn my actions more on the basis that I've insulted dogs by comparing them to the Israeli military. I think that would be a better case, really. You ought to really prosecute.
But I mean, look, the context of all of this is interesting, isn't it? Because we've also here in the UK had the threat of expulsion from the Labour Party of the former leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who has been vilified for his so-called anti-Semitic views and for expressing support for the Palestinians. So it's almost as if there are several fronts of this battle going on at the same time, if it is a psychological warfare battle.
I absolutely right. There is a multi-layered, exercise in forcing us to go for Big Brother speak. Basically, you know, you're not allowed to say anything to do with Israel without being pulled up, or about Jews. Now, the fact of the matter is that being a Jew, you know, does not mean you're a Zionist, and being Jewish of Jewish faith does not mean that you're a Zionist necessarily either. Being an Israeli, you'd be hard pressed to be a part of the Israeli military and not be supporting the Zionist movement or the Israeli state in terms of what it stands for and what it does in terms of apartheid, in terms of its torture, its maiming, its daily murder and general uncivilized behavior. So to me, the Israeli military would be fair game. And if we're not allowed to criticize a nation for its actions, or a nation's military for its actions, with colorful language, then of course you can see that they've set the red lines to distort what you should say. So what they're doing is they're scaring you away from any kind of criticism. That's where the real issue is. They don't want us to critique this particular institution, the Israeli institution, which is their pet. It's their primary means for balkanizing the Middle East. It's their primary, inflated manifestation. It's the Rothschild elitists that had their hands in creating Israel. And since then, they've created a mess across the entire region, which is impossible for them to really settle.
But what do you make of this battle on the home front, you know, rather than just on social media, with the threatening of the former leader of the Labour Party to be expelled for his views?
Well, I think it's disgusting. I mean, the bottom line is that everybody is going to be against hate speech. Everybody's against racism as such, towards individuals, be they Jewish or whatever. Jeremy Corbyn has never been a racist. He's obviously was one of the primary, vanguard for the protection of race relations in this country. He fought all his life, and the fact that they managed to stitch him up with this whole anti-Semitism malarkey on this bogus set of, charges, which I still can't make head or tail of. The fact is, the witch hunt that took place was contrived. It was set up. It was probably set up long before Jeremy was even brought into power. I was surprised that Jeremy even got the ticket. It could well be that those people who are in the backgrounds engineering such matters had it all planned out and had all this in store. Because, you know, at the end of the day, having made him an example, having shown that Jeremy Corbyn or the Labour Party is not beyond these people's scrutiny, of course it spreads fear and it sets a mark, marker for the rest of the population that, look, you do this, and if Jeremy Corbyn can't withstand our power, then who are you? So, of course, what it's had is the effect that the whole nation is now going to be even more paranoid about saying anything against Israel or Zionists, because you'll get accused of being a Jew hater as a result, or you'll get being called an anti-Semite. That's just a psychological fear that they've managed to engender with that one stroke. But the people who did it...
Okay, so what's the purpose of this action by the Israel lobby, whether it's successfully persuading the Labour Party to consider expelling Jeremy Corbyn or getting you removed from Facebook? What's coming down the line? What's the point of all of this?
Well, ultimately, the Israel lobby's job is to make sure that Israel's exceptionalism in the world is maintained. They have that exceptionalism. They had it for decades already. They just want to go to the next level. Nothing should be questioned. There's this kind of desire for everybody to keep their mouths shut as Israel becomes more and more totalitarian, which it has to, because Israel is illegitimate. It's surrounded now by a new wave of, if you like, especially Arab descent, called the Resistance Axis. It includes people that they've already proscribed now as terrorists, because again, the same institutions, Israeli exceptionalist institutions, have kowtowed to their desires to name whoever they want as terrorists. So what they've done is they've really cleared the ground for any opposition to what they want done in the Middle East, in that region, from the Western sources. So stopping Britain, the Netherlands, America, all of these powerhouses with their wealth, with their influence, with their democracy, with their talk about liberal democracy and human rights, well, that's all been silenced now. You can't squeak, because the minute you say anything against the Israelis, or you say anything against Zionism or Zionists, the Israeli lobby will trigger whatever they have in terms of blackmail, whether it's through the blackmail of being termed an anti-Semite or other blackmail, because, you know, so you don't forget that these guys, Israelis, have got the Unit 8200. They've had the Talpiot program, which essentially has high-tech chaps who are distributed across the entire Western world now as well. And they are, in extension to the Facebook argument, you've got these guys from the Talpiot program. Look up the Talpiot program that Israel has, which develops some of the highest powered techies who are then distributed into important positions around the Western world. Now, it's this kind of, influence, this kind of direction of political policy in the West, which is what they want. And they've got their people in place. They've got the money men in place, the money lenders and the money mafias, money power. They've got that on their side. And they intend to use that to manipulate things.
I mean, tell us a bit more about this Talpiot program, because that sounds to me as if you're saying that they're deliberate infiltrators. But then it might just simply be that the Israelis have got such good education systems around IT that their people are snapped up around the world.
Well, you know, $35 billion of aid from America pours into Israel, not without reason. There's the entire diaspora of money mafia, which also pours in privately funding to these institutions. Keeping Israel on its feet requires a lot of money, and it gets that money. And the Talpiot program, of course, if you've got industrial espionage, if you've got individuals dotted out around everywhere, if you have influence in the Congress, and if you have influence in the British Parliament through the lobbies, whether it's IPAC or whether it's the Israeli, the Friends of Israel here in the Conservative Party, etc., etc., if you've got such power and a fantastic organization, without a doubt, they've got an immensely powerfully organized network of intelligence, of influence politically, of influence financially, and of course they'll do it. They'll use it to survive, and to not only survive but to actually dictate where things are at and where things will go. And I think the Talpiot program is just one visible example of which they happen to have released to show off, to say, look, this is the scale of power we have. But let's get down to the brass tacks. This internet we're talking about, ultimately, the flow of traffic through this internet, I've read reports where it's alleged that this traffic actually all passes through the Israeli networks. And ultimately, if Mossad and if these networks have access to codes, well, how far does it go? Does it mean that the Israelis have actually secretly, do they have access to nuclear codes of whether it's the British nuclear weapon systems or whether it's the American weapon system? Is that why Israeli exceptionalism is so easily acquiesced?
Well, I don't think the Royal Navy or the British Army or whatever would put their nuclear codes anywhere near the internet. I hope they wouldn't anyway.
Well, one would hope not, but I'm just wondering that if the level of infiltration, I mean, all of these codes ultimately, are they going to be punched in manually? Do they get punched in? Who keeps these codes? Where do they store them? I mean, my question is the deep state and the shenanigans that go on there, and Israel's actual power within that field is very, very worrying, and I think to underestimate what they're capable of and what they actually do is really highly naive, given the scale of infiltration. Look, we constantly talk about Russia influencing our elections, yet nobody squeaks about Israel and its influence over parliamentary groups. Nobody talks about the funding and finance that goes to parliamentarians. Why not? Why isn't that an issue? Whereas Vladimir Putin is constantly, even today, being accused of having a hand in either American election gerrymandering or the British elections. But nobody talks about what's openly in our face, which is that Israel and Israeli lobbies and those forces that are fanned out across our systems, and if they're embedded to the structural systemic order, how far does that go? I mean, and would any investigating journalist even get as far as being able to suss out how far that goes these days? I doubt it. I mean, these days you're getting slammed for saying that the Israeli army are barbaric dog-like creatures for attacking wheelchair-bound people. I mean, far less would anybody be able to go out and investigate the depth of what Israeli power and control is within Western echelons of power.
Now, look, it'd be interesting to see what your take on this angle is, because I've been reading recently some comparisons between the creation of the Israeli state and the medieval Crusades. You know, the idea that Westerners, in fact, many Israelis are, for example, of Eastern European or Polish origin. I think Netanyahu's family are actually originally Polish. Charging across in medieval times to the Middle East to try and take over the Holy Land, fighting for Jerusalem many hundreds of years ago. Do you think it's there's any mileage in making comparisons there?
Well, the thing is that the Jews were the first victims of Zionism in the West. The Jewish people are the first victims of Zionism, because if you look at, say, groups like, for instance, Natura Cartae, who are hardcore Jews, who are traditional Jews, they will tell you out of their own history books, out of their own religious texts, just why modern day Zionism is actually the destroyer of Judaism in its real form. That, go to Natura Cartae, the rabbis. I've spoken to Rabbi Cohen, Michael Cohen, and Rabbi Weiss, and they tell me very straightforwardly that actually it was the Zionist engineered plan backed by the Rothschilds, which actually, first of all, gazumped and put the Jews into the front line. In the Middle East, the Jews were very rarely, if at all, given a hard time. In fact, they had a really good deal from the very early days of Islam's rise. There was a guy called Qab ibn Ahmar, who was the Jewish rabbi, the chief Jewish rabbi of Yemen. He actually converted to Islam. But when Jerusalem or Al-Aqsa in the 7th century, the first caliph, when conquered that territory of Jerusalem, it was a Jewish rabbi, a former Jewish rabbi, Qab ibn Ahmar, who was with the first caliph, and they actually, there was no bloodshed, there was no pillaging, no destruction. The Jewish fraternity have had a very good, if you like, deal with the Islamic world by and large. The Muslims tend to have killed each other quite happily. When it came to the Jews, they seemed to offer them protection and support right from the very early days, because there wasn't a Jewish hatred installed within the Islamic creed right from the beginning. In fact, they regarded themselves as a continuation of the same message. So Ka'b ibn Ammar, this former Jewish chief rabbi of Yemen, accompanies the first caliph to actually also tell him where everything is, how everything should be dealt with. So that was the beginning of the relationships of, you know, there's every reason for me to believe that Ka'b ibn Ammar was probably actually pretending to be Muslim, probably wasn't fully Muslim himself. They just did it convenience to save their skins. Quite a reasonable act, given that a powerful empire has just taken you over. So I'm going to carry on, because Jews lived comfortably in Jerusalem, they lived in Alexandria, they've lived in Istanbul. If you look at the Islamic empires, no matter how cutthroat those empires were and how, you know, autocratic, they always accommodated the Jewish communities as tradespeople, as people who were protected. They had their own quarters. And there's not the same, if you like, history as Christianity, for instance, has with the Jewish people. There's none of that heavy duty sort of persecution and killing. In fact, they amalgamated very well. If you look at someone like Maimonides in Moorish Spain, Toledo, and the libraries and Cordoba, all of that period of learning with the likes of Averroes and Ibn Arabi and Ibn Rushd, you know, the shining lights of, if you like, logic and philosophy and thinking and learning. Well, the Jews were hand in hand with them there. So there's been this constant collaboration, cooperation between Muslims and Jews. And even today, I don't think the Arabs or generally myself as a Muslim, we have got nothing against the idea of Jews living in the Middle East. We've got nothing against the idea of Judaism coexisting. The problem is Zionism. The problem is what they did to Palestine, basically taking away somebody else's home and pretending it was theirs, and now still continuing the lie. Not only doing that, but also exacerbating that lie by continuing to torture, murder, maim, and kill in order to justify.
But I mean, if the Muslims can have their own states in the Middle East, why can't the Jews?
Well, you know, Europe, perhaps, originally, I do recall that nobody had a problem with the Jews having a state. And apparently they were looking for Uganda, was one of the places earmarked for the Zionist state. But to walk into somebody else's home and just take it and then legitimize it as if it's okay, it's not right. Okay, unless we're back into those barbaric days where, you know, armies conquered and took over other lands and that's it, and you took whatever you want. Well, in that case, that's fine. Then Israel and the West should stop pretending that it has democratic values. It should stop talking about civilized values and democracy and equality and fairness. We should put that into the garbage tray and say what it is, that we're a plunder, rape, pillage kind of fraternity. Not much.
Yes, but the thing is that Jerusalem is surely the Jews' home, isn't it?
Well, technically, before the Israelites, even if we went to the Bible, let me just even if I went to the Bible's argument, well, who was living in Jerusalem when Joshua turned up? There was something called the Philistines, I gather, and I dare say they'd been living there for quite some time before. So if the Philistines were Palestinians, because that name sounds awfully like the word Palestine, if these guys were there and the people who were indigenous to that land prior to the Jewish biblical version of their arrival back there, then what would be their rights? What would be the rights of the people who lived there already? Would they have a God-given right? Well, you know, if God is giving us all our rights of land, etc., then I don't know whether that's you can submit that in a court of law. We could call God up perhaps and bring him into a legal, you know, legal discussion with ourselves. It's just nonsense, isn't it? I mean, how can you bring forward that argument? I mean, on what basis? And will the Aborigines want all of Australia back now, or should we give America back to the Native Americans perhaps? You know, maybe the slaves, we've just had the Black Lives Matter movement. Maybe we should, you know, give them back the land that they had wherever they were taken away from, perhaps Africa. I don't know. I mean, where do we take such arguments? It really is quite mind-boggling that that argument even gets put on the table, to be honest. It's straightforward. The Zionists wanted to create a disruption in the Middle East. They knew the oil was there. They needed a linchpin, a pawn in the region that would do their bidding. Israel is that linchpin. It's the pawn. It's been there for 100 years, not just because the Zionists wanted Israel to have a Jewish homeland. It's because they wanted to control the bulk of the resources in the Middle East, which they knew perfectly well through all the Rockefellers and all the kind of oil exploits that they were up to. They knew perfectly well what was there under the ground. And to control all of that, you need a military policeman. You need a force in that region where you can land your troops, and it acts as your force of imperial control. And that's how they've used Israel. And I think they've mugged a load of people from various kind of places in Eastern Europe, whatever, probably Ashkenazi Jews who've been imported, who have no connection with that land, were not born there, don't have a heritage either, because we're not even sure whether those people are from Georgia originally, or they're originally from those lands. I'm not sure what the DNA checks are. What is true, though, is that the Palestinians belong there. They've been there since time immemorial. And also the Jews who lived there originally were clearly there. There's some sort of argument for diaspora Jews to be able to link back to there. My argument is very simple. Yes, let's have a one-state solution. We've been saying that for ages. But then in that one-state solution, you must give the right of vote to every person who has a link to that plot of land. Whoever originally has a link should be given a vote, should be allowed back the right of return, and then you can start a state which is make it a secular state which actually doesn't have the apartheid rules, regulations, and the laws that the current fascist Zionistic leadership imposes and insists on having. So this charade of democracy of the Zionist entity is a nonsense. If they want real democracy, let all the Palestinians back in. Let anybody who claims to have a heritage back in, and let their children back in, let their children's children back in, and then have a democratic voting system and create a state which is based on real rule of law, not this kind of Zionistic fascism.
But the wall is not down yet, is it? This is not going away, this conflict. Where do you think it's heading?
I think it's going towards war. I don't think there's you see a bully, and a violent bully at that, only knows one language. Ultimately, they don't want to let go of what they've got, unless there are two things. Unless the Americans stop supplying the funds and the diaspora Jews stop resourcing Israel, it will remain, and it will remain so that the Arabs will have to go to war with it eventually. Or if they do pull out the funds and stop supplying the lifeline to Israel, because without that lifeline, it cannot survive. It doesn't have the means. It doesn't have the resources to survive for very long. Then they will collapse. That would probably be the least bloody way of resolving the problem, is that the diaspora Jews and the Western powers and the individuals that patronize Israel simply cut off the supply line of funds and resources that keeps it alive and well, which would force them to actually then deal with things without being the bullies that they are. The other alternative is, of course, what is coming, they're trying to avert it desperately, is that the axis of resistance is getting more and more powerful, whether it's technologically with military sort of means, whether it's on the ground in terms of their military exploits in Syria and understanding how to fight wars. That old fear that they'd imposed on Western Asia about their power and their enormous power is fading. It started fading in 2006 when Hezbollah gave them a bloody nose and they had to withdraw from Lebanon, and they didn't get their own way. And the Hezbollah knocked out tanks and stopped the whole Israeli army. That destroyed the myth of an invincible Israeli army. That is no longer there. And as they are doing now, their primary concern is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has ballistic missile capability, has rocket power, which could provide at least some opposition. Of course, the Israelis have over 300 to 400 nuclear warheads. What are they going to do with those? Who are they going to blow up with those? If they blow up anything in that region, it's going to affect them as well. the sensible thing is for them to give up this delusion that they actually are the owners of this land and to come to a proper one-state solution, which they pay reparations, rehouse, rebuild the Palestinians, access to the to that territory. But will they do it? Would they give away all those houses they've stolen in Jerusalem, all those villages, all those towns that they built up on now? How do they resolve the people who used to live there and their rights? Would that be something that only the international community could get together and resolve. However, I think the only way this is going to be resolved ultimately is a head-to-head war, and I think it is coming. It's just a matter of time.
Okay. Zeynep Saeed Abbas, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.